Memoria Press now offers 8 levels of the Simply Classical curriculum for children with special needs. These full-year packages help you teach reading, writing, arithmetic, art and music, poetry, science, history, Latin, classical and Christian studies in incremental and multisensory ways for mastery. Visit classicalspecialneeds.com and enter promo code LPR9 to save on resources for your home or school.
Those of you who are worried about making your kids go to church and how that might leave them hating religion, the numbers actually say precisely the opposite. Those families who treat church as optional, they're the ones who are on the road to basically losing their faith.
I came to the conclusion that I don't believe that the ELCA is evangelical. I don't believe that it's Lutheran. Is it Christian? You can judge for yourself. I personally am doubting that it is. I mean, I guess it's in America. That's about all you can say for it.
Christ has taught me in his living and dying and living again how to pray when you must bear a cross. And he prays, Lord, take this cup from me. But Lord, thy will, not mine.
New York City subway riders, love issues, etc.
The argument that has so much traction in the LGBT community, whether it is making laws, applying anti-discrimination laws, making arguments in kind of a casual way, is born that way. I was born that way. You cannot say anything negative about the way I was born because this is who I am. It's not only who I identify as or my inclination or my orientation, it is my identity, the word of the century. Greetings and welcome to Issues Etc. live on this Friday afternoon, September the 13th. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in. Well, there was a study, a massive study done that found many things, among them that there is no evidence for a gay gene. The born that way argument doesn't have at least a genetic support. We'll be talking with Dr. Jennifer Roback Morse about that study and what it may mean or not mean. We'll discuss Holy Cross Day observed by the church on the 14th of September with Pastor Larry Bean. Then Pastor Chris Roseborough joins us for This Week in Pop Christianity. Does the Bible teach that Christians can, wait for it, time travel, featuring Patricia King and Katie Souza? Then we're going to play Issues Etc., Soundbite of the Week, a simple game we like to play with our listeners where we play 4 soundbites from this week's audio. After we have played them, you give us a call, 1-877-623-6943. Send us an email, talkback@issuesetc.org. Send us a tweet @issuesetc, or go to our Facebook fan page, facebook.com/issuesetc, and vote for one of them to be Issues Etc. Soundbite of the Week. Joining us to talk about new findings on a gay gene, Dr. Jennifer Roback Morse, founder and president of the Ruth Institute. Jen taught economics for 15 years at Yale and George Mason University. She's senior research fellow in economics for the Acton Institute and author of several books, including her latest, The Sexual State. Jennifer, welcome back.
Thanks for having me, Todd. It's great to be talking with you again.
Why do you think the born this way or born that way argument has so much traction?
Oh, I can tell you exactly why. The gay establishment realized that if they could prove that homosexuality was somehow an immutable trait of a person, then they could import all of anti-discrimination law, lock, stock, and barrel, into the protection of homosexual persons and homosexual acts and all the rest of it. And so the prize, if you will, is anti-discrimination law that was developed, as we all know, to deal with the legacy of racism and slavery and Jim Crow and all of that, which race is certainly an immutable trait. You cannot become black or not black as you choose, you know, Elizabeth Warren notwithstanding. Your race is an immutable trait, and the immutability of the trait was something that the courts always found relevant to discrimination law. So if they could prove, or claim at least, if they could claim that sexual orientation, another invented word, if sexual orientation was an immutable trait, then they could use all of anti-discrimination law to their advantage. And that's exactly what they have done in the courts of law.
How has the acceptance of homosexuality moved at such breakneck speed in spite of the fact that no evidence has been found for a genetic origin to homosexuality?
That's the interesting question, isn't it? I mean, I can remember, Todd, it's been over 10 years ago now when the Prop 8 litigation was going through the courts. You know, you remember all of that. You and I have been talking to each other for that long, for sure. But I remember noticing that when they brought in expert witnesses to say, Prop 8 is it a law which changes the Constitution, is itself unconstitutional. I mean, it was a completely crazy from the start. But I noticed that they did not bring in a single expert to say sexual orientation is an immutable trait. They did not even attempt to defend that or prove that in court. They just kept asserting it. They kept acting like it was true. And so what we can, if we look at that and take kind of the big picture of what the gay rights movement has done, is they have used, they've invested a lot of money. Let's put it that way. The gay establishment and the sexual revolutionary establishment, that's all part of the same group of people in a way, they have invested a lot of money in convincing everybody that people are born that way, and therefore they deserve legal protections that would not be available to any other kinds of behaviors.
So tell us about this study of almost 500,000 people. That's a huge study.
Yeah, it's a huge study, you know, and so many things in this area have been based on convenience samples of, you know, 10 people who signed up at a lesbian coffee house or something like that. So this study was based on it's actually a study of genetics, and it was based on people who have given genetic samples to companies like 23andMe, these kind of companies that are out there. You can send in a swab out of your cheek. You can get a little bit of saliva, send it into the company, and they will analyze it and find out if you have any relatives. So people who maybe have a long-lost adopted child who was put up for adoption years ago, or somebody who's a donor-conceived person or something like that, there are a lot of people who have basically given their genetic information to these companies so that they can try to find their relatives, which is kind of an interesting thing, isn't it, when you think about it? But we won't go down that rabbit hole. Anyway, that's how they had all this data, Todd. And these are people who not only gave their swabs or whatever, but who also gave permission to be studied, right? So they have, with this data set, they're asking people a whole variety of questions. They've got their genes, right? They got all that. They already gave you that with the little, you know, your little Q-tip that you put in your cheek and mailed in. You've already done that. So now they ask a whole series of questions. And what was interesting to me, Todd, is that they didn't just ask, do you identify as gay? They also ask you about your number of sexual partners and how many male, how many female, and that kind of thing. So they were looking at, I would say, one of the most rigorous definitions of what it means to be gay in the first place. And you and I have had this conversation before, that the term gay is an scientifically very ambiguous term. And this study confirms that. So if you look at people who say I'm gay, and you look at people who say I've had X number of partners of this sex or the other, they don't match up perfectly, right? And the other interesting thing they found is this so-called Kinsey scale, that a person is on the continuum of gay to straight. That isn't really true either, you know, so there, you've got people who might self-identify in one way, have fantasies of a different way, and report different numbers or percentages of sex partners. So it's a very sophisticated piece of work here, and it confirms what people have known since the 1990s, Todd, which is that the term gay is not a uniquely and carefully scientifically defined term. And so there it is, with 500,000 a sample of 500,000 people now confirming this thing that you and I have talked about numerous times before.
Is it going to make any difference? I mean, the fact of the matter is they proceeded without evidence in the beginning, and this further lack of evidence, this further dearth of any kind of evidence, to my mind, won't make any difference at all. They're just going to keep arguing. We are born this way. It's an immutable trait.
Right. Well, I think it's very important for Christians to pick up the ball and run with it, and to run with it in the proper way. So sometimes people will say, if you weren't born that way, you must mean that we chose this. You know, and so that's the dichotomy that people are presented. Well, why would anyone choose to be gay? Of course, those aren't all the alternatives, right? So there's no genetic determination of your sexual desires and your sexual behavior. But what Christians need to say is that every person is born with original sin, And things happen to us that send that and send our sinful tendencies into particular directions rather than some other particular direction. And all along the way, we're making decisions about how to behave, about how to interpret what's happened to us, about what to consider important, what information to share with others, what labels to pin on ourselves. We're making morally significant choices all through the process. And so that's one of the things that we need to say. It's not like there's a switch that says, okay, I'm gay, and now I decide I'm gay. Although people act like that's the case, you will find people who have been through the gay lifestyle and have walked away from it. You will find them saying, in retrospect, describing how many steps there really were to get to that point. So I think we need to keep the conversation open and not, we don't want to jam people into categories so much. You see what I mean? Give people a chance to say, well, this is what's happening. This is what did happen. And we lead them along to say, you know, that's right. And let's think about a different interpretation of what happened to you. Let's think about a different significance to assign to what happened to you. So there's a lot of different places where Christians can make a difference, and it's very important that we be part of that conversation.
More broadly, Jennifer, it seems there's a collision course within the sexual revolution today between the argument that sexual orientation is an immutable trait, but somehow gender isn't. The born that way argument seems to be headed on a collision course for the I was born a man, but I'm really a woman argument.
Yes. Yes. Oh, the collision course, nothing. They've crashed. I mean, they're already crashing into each other. The T's and the L's in the LGBT so-called coalition, the T's and the L's are already at open warfare with each other, because the lesbians believe, correctly in my view, that the transgender men are invading female space by saying, hi, I'm really a woman, so I get to come into your locker room and your bathroom and compete in your sports. And the lesbian women are going, what the heck just happened here? You know, and so what the fundamental underlying error here, Todd, is something that Christians really can help with. Because whether you're saying my sexual orientation I'm born with, I can't change it, I get to have sex with a person of my same sex because this is how I was born, that's saying that the sex of the body is irrelevant when it comes to sexual activity. I get to have sex with whoever I feel like having sex with. The transgender ideology is saying the sex of the body is so irrelevant, I can change it if I feel like it. Right. So in both cases, the error is the same. It's the underlying Gnostic error, which is that the human body doesn't matter, insignificant, can be overwritten by our thoughts and desires. And by the way, with the help of technology and the law, we can overwrite our bodies. But Christians say, and have always said, and I don't think there's any daylight at all between Lutherans and Catholics, or ever has been on this issue, which is that the human body is something significant, that we are embodied creatures, male and female, he created them, and that this embodiment is good and nothing to be ashamed of or hide from, you know? And that's what Christians need to be saying. That's what the world needs to hear.
So I guess what I'm wondering is, at some point, someone is going to challenge illegally this notion, yes, of immutable trait. They're, yes, going to go into court, what has not been raised as a subject because they fear it could be disproven is now going to be raised, and someone's going to say, and a judge is going to say, I'd like to see some evidence that this is an immutable trait. Maybe even a Supreme Court justice might ask for such evidence.
Wouldn't that be nice, Todd? I mean, I've been saying that for a long time, that they should be challenging this, that our legal guys should be challenging this point. Call their bluff. Call their bluff. Prove that it's an immutable trait. Give us the evidence that it's an immutable trait. No, I really hope somebody will put that into part of the legal arguments. There are a couple of court cases right now working their way through to the Supreme Court, and people are preparing briefs and all of that. And I do hope somebody is going to raise this challenge, because it's absolutely key.
Will it be relevant even then? Because if the argument has had such traction in the courts without evidence, it seems to me that someone says, well, we don't have any evidence, but we still believe it to be true, might still fly in a court of law.
I, you know, I'm the wrong person to ask about what's going to fly in a court of law, because, you know, that's just not what I do. But I do think that if the court said, nope, we're not going to treat this legally as an immutable trait anymore, we're going to change the way we view sexual orientation and sexual conduct and so on, it's not going to be a protected class. We're not going to allow it to be a protected class. You've tried that argument, and we reject the argument that this should be a protected class. I think that will have consequences that will ripple throughout the society. And exactly what those look like, I don't know for sure. But I think it's very important that somebody call their bluff and flat out say, this should not be treated as a protected class because of the science. Not because, and Todd, this is where I have, you know, cross swords with some of our friends. We should not be defending this on the basis that we have the First Amendment and we're entitled to our Christian beliefs, our deeply, sincerely held religious beliefs that male and female are different. No, we should not be defending it on that basis. We should be defending ourselves on the basis that it's true. Christianity is not some peyote cult that can only survive with First Amendment protection. Christianity can survive because it's true. And on something like this, I mean, we're looking at the natural law. It's not like we're arguing about transubstantiation or something. I mean, we're talking about, is there a human body and is it male and female? You know, anyone should be able to observe that. So I certainly hope somebody makes a federal case out of it, as we used to say. I hope somebody will make a federal case out of it, because we should win.
So I know you're not an attorney, but if you would, why don't you just outline, if you were asked to testify in such a hearing, what would you say about why we should not regard sexual orientation as an immutable trait akin to race, or I would prefer to say skin color in this case?
Well, what I would say is, I would first of all say, how would you propose to define membership in this class or not? If being a lesbian, for example, is to be a protected class, how do we define whether I, for instance, am a lesbian? I would stand there and say, you know what? I'm a lesbian because I say so. Prove that I'm not a lesbian. What could possibly be the criteria that you would use in a court of law to say you're in the category, you're not in the category? And how can you have a protected class that you define yourself into? That's what I would say. That's what I would try to argue.
So in other words, you would go after this kind of notion run amok now that I am what I say I am, or I am,
yes,
what I believe I am.
Yes, yes, exactly. Now, here you and I might get into a conflict, because to me, this is what nominalism is all about, right? Nominalism says that reality is whatever we say it is, and truth is whatever we say it is, and objects don't have any substantial reality apart from our names for them. You know, that was a big thing in the 14th century or whatever. And this is what a nominalist society looks like, people. You know, this is where you chop off people's body parts because they say those body parts don't belong to them. You know, I mean, that's what nominalism means in reality. And this philosophy has been on a collision course with a realist philosophy. I don't even care what realist philosophy you're talking about, but nominalism versus realism has been going at it for a long time. And nominalism has been triumphing in society, and this is what it looks like. And it's time that we have a dose of philosophical realism and apply it all the way down.
You have watched the sexual revolution unfold and written extensively about its course. Where do you think it is headed, given all the internal conflict now within what is commonly called the LGBTQ community, which now, in essence, has taken over the sexual revolution?
Well, you know, they have and they haven't taken over. You know, you mustn't underestimate the power of the pro-abortion people who are, although they're all allied, you know, the abortion people and the LGBT people are allied with each other. They are different people and they do have different objectives to some extent, but they are united in their common view of human sexuality and its place in our lives. And so from that perspective, you can say, yeah, there's a big phalanx of them all moving in the same direction. And are you asking me, where do they want to go with it? What is the end point of this thing? Is that what you're asking me?
Well, yeah, I mean, I actually am interested in that. Where are they wanting to go? Because they've had so much success getting where they want to go so far. Where do you think they do want to go?
Well, I am quite certain I know where they want to go. Now, whether they'll make it or not depends a lot on what we do as Christians and how we respond and whether the Lord works any miracles for us, which he's quite capable of doing. But if you remember from my book, I have three sections to the sexual revolution, and the gender ideology is one facet, one of three facets of the sexual revolution. The ultimate goal of the gender ideology is to completely wipe out male and female as categories in society, in law, in everything, that we would all be gender fluid, non-binary people. That's their goal of the gender ideology. No question it. That's what they want. The divorce ideology, you and I haven't talked about that in a while, but the divorce ideology, which says that kids don't really need their parents and adults can couple and recouple any way they want, the kids will all be fine. The ultimate goal of that group of people is what I would call contract parenting, Todd. They're actually writing about it in law reviews and stuff like that. And contract parenting means the complete separation of biology from the legal definition of parenthood. So two or three people can get together and purchase the egg and the sperm and rent the services of a surrogate and so on and so forth. And these people can make a contract about who is going to have legal parenting rights over the child, and that those contracts would all be legally enforceable. That's what those people want. And the third ideology is what I call the contraceptive ideology, which says that a good society should do everything possible to separate sex from babies. And that's where the pro-abortion people come in to play. Those people, there's no question in my mind what they want, Todd. They want population control. They've wanted population control from the beginning. And those people with all of their money, those people are gravely, gravely culpable for the whole big picture of this thing, because they've put so much money into the whole global ideology of separating sex from babies, physically and morally and mentally and culturally and everything else. There's no question that's what they want.
Dr. Jennifer Roback Morris is founder and president of the Ruth Institute. She taught economics for 15 years at Yale and George Mason universities. She's senior research fellow in economics for the Acton Institute and author of several books, including her latest, The Sexual State. You can purchase The Sexual State and find out more about the Ruth Institute at our website, issuesetc.org. Click On Demand Archives. Jennifer, thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
On the other side of the break, we're going to be talking about a day, a very ancient day observed by the church on September 14th, Holy Cross Day. Pastor Larry Bean, sermons editor for Gottesdienst, the Journal of Lutheran Liturgy, will be our guest. I'm Todd Wilkin. This is Issues, Etc.
Looking for a foreign language program that will revolutionize your students' vocabulary knowledge and their understanding of grammar? How about a program that teaches critical thinking skills, too? Look no further than Memoria Press's Latin curriculum. Students of all ages can use these Latin study programs. Give your students the gift of Latin today. To order, visit memoriapress.com and save $5 on your next order by using the coupon code LPR9. Memoria Press, saving Western civilization one student at a time.
Hey, Todd, what have our listeners noticed first when visiting the LPR studios?
Definitely the small size and the dirt.
Well, not anymore. Thanks to our friends at the Cleaning Authority, they've turned this man cave into a space that meets even our wives' approval.
Whether it's our office or your home, the Cleaning Authority is your cleaning service provider in the St. Louis area.
To schedule a free estimate or to find out more, visit thecleaningauthority.com. Thecleaningauthority.com.
We love our on-demand listeners. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Church music directors can find a new community at Prelude to Postlude, the CPH music blog. Learn helpful tips for managing music ministry and involving members, and meet the composers of some of your favorite new pieces. Plus, find suggestions of music to use for special services and preview some of our newest works with free samples you can use at your church. Visit us at preludetopostlude.org.
An average of 20 military veterans kill themselves every day. Project Operation Barnabas is a network of LCMS congregations who reach out to veterans and their congregations and their communities with the gospel of Jesus Christ. Operation Barnabas is a program of LCMS Ministry to the Armed Forces. Find out more at lcms.org/armedforces. Serving those who serve. LCMS Ministry to the Armed Forces. lcms.org/armedforces.